25 years ago, a lot of people may have considered Seattle kind of a rainy port town with a big space needle downtown and a big airplane factory on the edge of town. In September 1991, Nirvana released its major label debut, Nevermind, and it became a huge hit, and it helped transform the image of Seattle into an international hub of art, technology, and cosmopolitan cafe society. This weekend, Seattle's Experience Music Project opens the first major exhibition ever devoted to Nirvana and the music scene that spawned it. Marcy Silman, member station KUOW, takes a look back at the band and the city it changed.
When Alice Wheeler came to Seattle 30 years ago, she was a teenager who loved punk rock.
This was a great neighborhood. When I first moved here in the early 80s, there were three different punk rock clubs on this block. My favorite one was in this building, and it was called The Grey Door.
Today, it's a coffee house. Alice Wheeler has spent the past three decades photographing Seattle's fringe scene, her fellow punks, musicians, and disaffected kids. It's raining outside, a light, steady mist Wheeler calls daffodil rain.
Today is the perfect grunge day because it's like flat gray. I was looking out over the water. You couldn't see the edge of the water and where the sky began in the mountains.
Grunge. In the late 1980s, that word was shorthand for rock bands with a heavy, distorted guitar sound, for flannel shirts and long johns under cut-off jeans. Grunge was synonymous with Seattle. Grunge was a gritty sound that developed in a gritty port city.
It was before the internet boom and the coffee and all the giant companies. I mean, you had Boeing and you had the naval shipyards. I ended up working at a naval shipyard in Bremerton for a few years.
Jack Endino left the shipyards to join a band called Skin Yard. To support his music, he got a day job at a recording studio. That's where he got a call from a kid from Aberdeen, a logging town southwest of Seattle.
1988, yeah, January of 88. Here comes this band with no name. Kurt Cobain and his friends. They could only afford one reel of tape, and they filled the tape up, and it ran out in the middle of the 10th song, and they said, well, that's okay, just put a fade ending on that song, and we're done, we don't have any more money. And then I played it for John Poneman.
In 1987, Jonathan Poneman and his partner Bruce Pavitt started a company called Sub Pop Records to put out singles by local bands.
And I was halfway through the first song on the tape, and Kurt launches into a roar, and I was just, oh my God.
At the time, Seattle's music scene was tiny. A couple hundred people traipsed around from one impromptu club to the next. Back then, Charles Cross edited a weekly newspaper about Seattle's music scene. He went on to write the Kurt Cobain biography, Heavier Than Heaven. Standing in front of white sheetrock that walls off an Urban Outfitters stockroom, it's hard to imagine there was a club here.
And the club that we're standing in had a smell. It was a basement smell. Everything about Nirvana smelled like basements. The recording studios they were in, where they live, there's a mustiness.
But by 1989, Nirvana was on its way out of the basement. Sub Pop had just released the band's first album, Bleach. In a stroke of marketing genius, the label flew over a British music writer to check out the Seattle scene. His article opened the floodgates. In a short period of time, the bands Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and Mudhoney all signed contracts with major labels. Their records sold well, but nobody was ready for 1991, when MTV picked up Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit video from the album Nevermind.
It was everywhere. I mean, my band was touring Europe at the time, and we were hearing it everywhere over there.
Record producer Jack Endino.
I remember one of the major label people being quoted in an article. Someone said, oh, you guys did a really good job of promoting that record. And they said, we didn't promote it. You just had to get out of the way and duck.
Nevermind sold a million copies within the first 6 months of its release. Nirvana went from a trio with no name to number one on the Billboard charts. By 1991, Seattle had already started to change. 5 years earlier, Microsoft moved to a suburb and made its initial public stock offering. That same year, 1986, Howard Schultz bought his first coffee house. A year later, Schultz acquired a company called Starbucks. Cobain biographer Charles Cross.
What happened is that the combination of there being software jobs, the combination of things like Starbucks getting national attention, and then the music scene made anyone who was 22 years old, who had just left college and was hip, move to Seattle.
The city's days as a blue-collar outpost were over.
This corner may be the most vivid example of the changes in the city of Seattle. This is a 13-story glass, steel, and granite, environmentally certified office building where King County executive Dow Constantine works.
From this window, you can see where the clubs, the Gorilla Room and Gorilla Gardens and Metropolis and the Central Tavern, which was tremendously important, you could see those all from the window.
Dow Constantine runs the county that includes Seattle and its suburbs. 25 years ago, a different Constantine was behind a microphone at the local alternative music station. Both the man and the city have shed their scruffy images.
I don't think that you can say that it was a bad thing that we became well off. But it does do things like increase real estate values. It makes it harder to run a seedy club where bands can come play for $5. You got to be able to make money if you're going to pay the rent.
Some bands and some hipsters fled south to Portland, Oregon. Seattle's music scene is thriving. It's the sound that's changed.
I wish I was a slave to an age-old trade, like riding around on rail cars and working long days.
You probably see a lot of people wearing flannel right now, because that seems to be back in, flannel beards and folk.
Jacob McMurray is senior curator of Seattle's Experience Music Project. McMurray says grunge may be a 20-year-old memory, but it's part of a continuum of Seattle pop music, from Jimi Hendrix to the Sonics to the next unnamed trio.
What happened in Seattle, you know, and in the Northwest couldn't have happened if it was L.A. or if it was New York. And that's because to most of the people in the universe, the Northwest is unknown. I mean, it was this mythical place, you know, and so it didn't bring up any kind of preconceptions.
Seattle was a frontier town that attracted people who wanted to invent new things and to reinvent themselves. Bill Boeing, Bill Gates, Kurt Cobain. 2 decades after Nirvana hit it big with Nevermind, Seattle is slicker and richer. But photographer Alice Wheeler says the city still beckons.
I still meet kids all the time that still have that punk grunge spirit. It's just as cool as it ever was.
Maybe just not as loud. For NPR News, I'm Marcy Silman in Seattle.
Seattle is always cool. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.